Hello and welcome. You're listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. Hello and welcome to episode 76 of Writers Aloud. In this episode, we feature the second part of Caroline Moorhead's interview with Carol Angia, where she speaks about the courage she admires in her subjects and when to speak or stay quiet as a biographer. You can hear the first part of this interview in episode 72.
I think I do admire courage, and I think I admire it partly because I feel I lack it myself. And Martha's courage was the courage to face old age and death. I mean, I think she was brave in wars and so on, but I think that's probably a great deal easier. I think the real courage is facing up to being old and infirm and dying. And I think in the case of Lucie Latour du Pin, the courage was surviving her children dying and managing to live for what there was. So I suppose it's courage in the face of adversity that I suppose really interests me.
You and Shakespeare and Goethe, exactly. And, you know, everybody.
Tom, really. Dick and Harry. I do say, I agree, it's rather banal.
No, it is not banal. That's not what I meant
No,
at all.
I know you didn't mean that, but no, now you say it, I do think it was
crucial. It's absolutely crucial because it comes back to that, you know, no trouble, no story. I mean, the whole point of life is how do you survive it? And why do we read? We read to find out how people survive,
exactly.
You know. And so let's write that.
Yeah.
Now, the reason I like Martha Gellhorn so much is that actually you portray her very warts and all. And we see her weaknesses in depth. So, for example, the way she has so little empathy with people, and she discards them when she gets bored. She has abortions, apparently many of them, without apparently a thought. And the way she treats her adopted son, she treats him even with outright cruelty when he disappoints her. And she's a war lover, really, and she can't cope with peace at all. So actually, she's quite a horror in lots of ways. And you make this very clear, and she's completely wonderful. Now, why did this happen in particular with Martha?
What I had for the Martha Gellhorn book was I had all her papers and letters, which were in an archive in Boston. And she wrote very personal letters, many, many of them. And there were a lot of people still alive who knew her very well who talked about her. And she was very candid about what she thought and felt. So it was all there to do. What I quite liked was the fact that I didn't want to end up particularly taking a view myself as to whether I thought she was good or bad, because I thought that, like almost everybody else, she was both good and bad. And almost the same number of people said to me, my God, you didn't like your subject, as, my God, you really did like that terrible woman. And that pleased me, because it made me feel I'd actually put it down on the line.
But it is, isn't it, one of the great thrills and advantages, in a way, to a writer, of writing about contemporaries, or the only recently dead, where there are still people who knew Martha, for example, whom you could talk to, whereas you couldn't talk to anybody who had known Lucie Latour du Pin. So there is inevitably some kind of greater closeness to a contemporary figure.
There was a moment with Lucie Latour du Pin which frustrated me appallingly. She had a friendship with a woman who was extremely difficult and duplicitous, and their relationship was troubled. And I knew also that she'd fallen out with her friend and remained great friends with this woman's daughter. And they'd kept up a correspondence afterwards. So the mother fades from the scene and the daughter takes over, as it were. But I sensed that in this relationship with this woman, there was a side to Lucie Latour du Pin's character that was less obviously straightforward. So I discovered in a reference in a book published in the 19th century, a little line which referred to the papers of this woman. And I thought, this is going to be brilliant. Could I find them? No. I cannot tell you how I searched for those papers. Every now and again I'd get leads to collections of papers in some obscure French chateau, and I'd go there and I'd get the papers. Nothing. So in the end, I couldn't do that because I just did not have the stuff.
That's it. We are dependent on the stuff because we cannot make it up.
We cannot make it up. No, no. Mm. I believe passionately in not making up.
It's reductive, of course, to diagnose our subjects, you know. However, Martha Gellhorn, your portrait of her is such a rich one, I think she can take this. And you do show her taking antidepressants at the end of her life, and you actually say that she was, quotes, fundamentally rather depressive. So, to me, she sounded aspergery, this lack of empathy. And, you know, things like her hypersensitivity to weather, which you describe, that's a very Asperger type. How would you diagnose her, or do you think that that would be wrong, that she wasn't pathological enough for that to be useful?
I think she wasn't pathological enough for it to be useful. I do think that. I think that a lot of what seems like this sort of wayward and often unempathetic behaviour goes back to her strength of character and to her drive and to her restless nature.
Hmm. Well, like you, I admire people like that. So we like to write about them because we're not like it ourselves.
Certainly not like it ourselves.
Biography as compensation.
Exactly.
We shouldn't just leave Martha Gellhorn emphasizing these negative qualities. It was clear to me that you liked her very much and that therefore the reader also feels. I mean, I liked her a lot. Like her anger at governments, you know, bad governments, which means all governments, really. And at awful old Hemingway, I have to say, who's not my favourite either. So what would you like us most to remember about her?
Her humour. And maybe I haven't said enough, you know, how much I appreciate and like humour. The fact that I don't write humorous things myself does not mean that I don't hugely enjoy it in others. And I liked her delivery. I liked the sort of rueful, wry way she had of describing herself and life around her. I think that's probably what I like most of all. That, and of course the other thing we all gravitate towards as biographers, is intelligence. The brilliance of the mind, which is incredibly attractive to write about, because what you find yourself doing is you spend all your time with this person who is fascinating and clever and full of interesting things and knows things you don't know. That's a very attractive side of writing biography.
Absolutely, and to put their voice in your book, and because, gosh, they help.
Exactly, it was like Primo Levi. How wonderful to spend those years with Primo Levi.
Oh, yes. And he, too, had wonderful humour. He was the most ironic and wry person.
Yeah.
Yes, I can't do humour either. So, basically, we love our subjects because they give so much better than us. Brave, funny.
Exactly.
Okay, let's move on from Martha Gellhorn to Human Cargo. And I can testify, because I know about the subject of asylum, that it's one of the best and most moving books on that subject that I know. Your portrait in this book of the unjust and inhumane and stupid horrors, you know, of Egypt, of Italy, of Australia. Oh my God, Australia!
I know.
And of our own country, for refugees and asylum seekers, is so powerful that I don't know how anybody who's read this book could ever look at another tabloid headline. But the tabloid headlines continue, and they get worse, and government policy with it. Why is it so difficult to persuade people about the truths of around asylum that you tell us in your book, for example, that no one wants to be a refugee, that only the young and fit, very small layer of people, can do it, that 90% of refugees stay within their own region, and that there is no such thing as an illegal immigrant because the Refugee Convention recognises that refugees are often obliged to travel without documents. So all of these facts, which we repeat endlessly, and nobody ever seems to take on board, why? Why is it so difficult to persuade people of the truths about asylum?
Because we look for scapegoats, because they look like others. It goes back to the old thing about the underdog, the underperson, as with the Germans and the Jews. It's the need and desire to be superior to other people. It's a kind of racism and xenophobia. I think these are all things that lurk in the world, and they're encouraged by governments and many newspapers. What amazes me is that no politician in Europe has been able to grasp the nettle and try and put together a humane, just refugee and immigration policy for the whole of Europe.
Which would even save money, which actually. Which would save be practical huge, as well.
Huge amount of money. But it appears to be something that politicians are terrified of. So it's become easier to peddle all these untruths. I'm not arguing that everybody must be let in automatically, but I am arguing that every country, Western country, should face up to its obligations under the 1951 Convention, and that refugees should be recognised to be refugees in need of help. It's a terrible indictment of our humanity, I think, that we as a nation can't see that. I think how people treat refugees is a terrible lodestone of a nation's humanity. I mean, that sounds so pompous, but you know what I mean.
I couldn't agree more. There's one thing you describe in Human Cargo, another thing that I didn't know about, and that is the fence that runs between the US and Mexico. And we all know about the Berlin Wall, and we all know about the Israeli Wall, but I think very few of us have heard of this one. And you say it was 64 miles of it when you wrote the book, maybe it's more now, and that there were 10 times more deaths there in under a decade than happened at the Berlin Wall in 43 years. Now, researching and writing this bit must have been harrowing. So can you tell us about your researches around the US border wall? Yeah.
Well, you know what it's like. Even when you're researching the most depressing and difficult subjects, something of the innate, as it were, journalist in all of us is fascinated by trying to understand, and also then by the desire to convey what it is you're. And the most fascinating moment was when I went to the beach that separates California from Mexico at Tijuana, and the wall becomes a fence and runs down into the water and out into the water. And somebody told me that they had to keep adding to it because people used to swim round, and they added to it enough so that more people were likely to drown. And I thought, this is so terrible that they have devised this fence in such a way that anybody who tried it drowned. And what was so fascinating was sitting on the beach waiting for evening were gathered a whole lot of people who were going to go over the fence, and they wait until dusk, and then they go over the fence and start running, because the other side, rather like some ghastly children's game, there are all these policemen in cars with lights trying to pick them up and catch them, and it's sort of who can get past and get through. That was one of the most sort of visible aspects of what I was writing about, was this very moment when refugees are trying to get out and people are trying to stop them getting in. I've just been in Tunisia and Malta writing about the boat people, and specifically about the people who drown. And I interviewed a woman who was on that Syrian boat that went down, and nearly 300 people were drowned and a few were saved. And she described to me the moment when they got through to the customs office, the guards in Rome, and said, help, we're going down, we've got 95 children on board. And the people in Rome said, I'm sorry, you're not in our waters, try Malta. So they then got onto Malta, and Malta said, you're not in our waters. And by the time they decided that they couldn't put this off any longer, the boat had gone down. I mean, where does this leave human beings?
Where we've always been, I'm afraid, and not a very good place. I think we'll have to leave Human Cargo now and move on to your next biography, because in 2010 you went back to biography and you published Dancing to the Precipice, Lucie de la Tour du Pin and the French Revolution. So Human Cargo was 2005, so that's a gap of 5 years, which is a bigger gap than usual for you in the 2000s, but still very quick considering the massive amount of historical research that you do for this book. So my first question is, how do you do that?
I think the answer is that if you don't really do anything else, there's an awful lot of time. You know, my routine is to go to the library every day. I mean, I work every day. And it's amazing, as you know, how much ground one can cover. It was very, very enjoyable doing Manon Arthur Dupin because it was an area I didn't know about. So it meant the most wonderful amount of reading of memoirs and histories of the period. I mean, the days are long. One has lots of time.
You must read very quickly.
I do read quite quickly. And after all, you know, you and I have been taking notes, man and boy, for 30 years or so. And, you know, we're quite good at it now.
Well, it's true, but I'm an absolute crawler compared to you. I do not work fast, but still, this is not about me. One of the main things that struck me about Lucie de La Tour du Pin was, God, the times she lived through. Can you imagine living through the French Revolution and also the personal stuff that you've already mentioned to do with the fact that she, through her own miscarriages, her children's diseases and their miscarriages and pregnancies and so on, she loses all of her children except one. It's unimaginable to us today, I think. And it's such an extraordinary story. So what led you to Lucie de La Tour du Pin and what made you want to write this extraordinary and painful and
amazing tale? I came across, or at least I had had sometimes earlier, the Everyman edition of her own memories, memoir. And I thought that that was wonderful. But I realised that she wrote up to 1812, something around 1812, and she lived to 1853. So I realised there was a wonderful amount that had not been touched on. And I rather thought that I was going to have to wing it through other people's memoirs and biographies and official papers and things. But in this chateau in Belgium, I found letters which went from 1812 to 1853, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of them. And better than that, they'd been typed up.
I know what you mean. You should see Jean Rhys's handwriting.
Was it terrible?
Oh, terrible. Absolutely terrible. I became one of the world's experts in it. But now, something about Dancing to the Precipice struck me, and then it struck me about the others as well again. Like the French women of A Train in Winter, you're a resistor. And like Martha Gellhorn, you're a scourge of governments. And yet, interestingly, in Dancing to the Precipice, you're very clear about what a vicious society, of course, the Ancien Régime was, but you give the aristocrats a pretty good press. You know, they all go to their deaths with a great deal of dignity. Now, I'm wondering whether, is this what the evidence showed, overwhelmingly? Is this possibly what Lucie's evidence showed? And is it perhaps sympathy with the underdog in you? Or, the final question, if you can remember all of them, is this a bit of a division in you personally? Because all of these subjects of yours, while being resistors and so on, are very old-fashioned, quite conservative types. They all are upper class. They all are in close contact with the top people of their day. I mean, Martha Gellhorn with the Roosevelts, and they all move in, as it were, top circles. I'm wondering whether, despite your own dissenting views, you're a bit like them. You're an upper-class resistor.
Not sure I'd put it that way.
How would you put it?
I'm not sure I would put it that way. Just to go back to Madame de La Tour du Pin, again, it was the material I had. There was evidence that most of them went to their deaths amazingly well. A resistor. Well, again, I think it goes back to my belief in courage. I think that in a way we have no choice but to behave well, to stand up for the... And of course, yes, I'm very keen on the underdog. Always have been. I like the anarchical, impoverished, unentitled people. Those are the people I'm fond of and admire and I like. And I do feel a surge of rage against governments that oppress their people, which is what Martha was so driven by. You know, that the worst that happens to people is what's done to them by their governments. And when you hear Tony Blair, as I heard him this morning, justifying the war in Iraq, I thought, this is so revolting. Why do I have to listen to this? So, yes, there is in me certainly a love of the underdog and an admiration for people who support them. But, you know, I've never done anything myself at all brave. I've never actually gone out there and fought for anything.
I mean, it seems to me that going to Cairo and working with the Lost Boys, as you did, and setting up a legal centre for them and travelling around the world by yourself...
Often had a friend
everywhere.
With me.
Oh, you often had a friend. That's true. You often had a friend. Yes.
And also, as you know, these things aren't really brave.
You are in your way. Don't deny it.
Well, thank you.
All right, this brings us to your current work, which is a trilogy of books on the resistance in World War II. So the first we've already mentioned, A Train in Winter. That was published in 2011, and the second is due in 2014, and I know you're working on the third. So A Train in Winter is the story of 230 French women resistance workers who are caught and deported to Auschwitz, of whom only 49 returned. And as you pointed out, that is a high number compared to certainly the Jewish prisoners in Auschwitz, but still it's pretty minute. So again, this book is a work of complex research and lucid exposition. And it's again on a subject I know and care about. So again, I can say that I think it's remarkably accurate and insightful about Auschwitz, which I studied, I'm afraid, in some depth. So everything you say, for example, about the reasons why people died or survived is true. Can you sum up some of those reasons for us? And in general, the main lessons that you took away from doing this book?
It was quite quickly clear from the descriptions of these women about their time in Auschwitz that they looked after each other. And once I'd started noticing that, I noticed the degree in which they operated as a group, and the more frail and fragile ones were looked after by the stronger and tougher ones. And then I became really interested in how groups survive, how do you best look after each other. At some point during my research, I thought I need to find out how men were with each other in these same circumstances. So I went to talk to some of the men survivors on some of the earlier resistance trains who'd been there for only with men, had been in Auschwitz and so on. And I would say, you know, how were you all with each other, with your group? And they would be perplexed by my question. And several said to me, oh, no, no, we looked after ourselves. We just were completely determined to survive, and each one of us looked after ourselves. And it was at this point that I thought, I'm going to be more interested in what these women were up to. And I suppose what was really interesting was who survived. The older ones didn't survive, and they died very, very, very quickly. All those aged over 60 were dead within 3 weeks, and they didn't die of anything. That's what made it so peculiar. They didn't die of illness or starvation. They died of horror. And the young ones died. The young ones died because they psychologically couldn't hack it. So the people who survived, the women who survived, were all aged between about 25 and 35, i.e. at the peak of their emotional and physical strength. And because they were friends. They didn't all totally like each other, but what we were talking about were friends. And I found that completely fascinating. Again, because it played into my attachment to the idea of friendship and how powerful and strong it is.
It's fascinating. So the men whom you spoke to were also, like the women, they had arrived in a group of resistors, French resistors,
yes,
who knew one another, who'd worked together in a, or some of them anyway,
yes,
in a resistance group, and they still didn't have the same, as it were, bonding to one another as the women had. That is very interesting because, I mean, I think it's a very important thing to say that one way you could survive Auschwitz was by having friends, because the standard view, yeah, which is also true, is that it was just, you know, every one man for himself. In fact, as some people have said, even including at one point Primo Levi, but that was because he was very depressed at the time, that the worst survive. But in fact, Levi himself was a counterexample, because he survived. One of the reasons he survived was he had a friend.
Yes.
Alberto, and the, yes, two of them looked out for each other.
Yes.
And they had another friend, Leonardo, who looked out for both of them.
For both of them.
And that's one of the main reasons why he survived. And it also kept their humanity alive. I mean, you say that is very important. I have a person in my family who's a survivor, and she was a communist. And they belonged to a very tight little group of communist women, not necessarily from the same country, but they were all communists, and they looked out for each other. Now, would you not have thought there might be that in the men?
Yes, and I didn't do enough research to see how much that was true. Certainly, among my women, the communist women also looked after each other specially, because they went into it already as a sort of looking after group.
Yes.
One has to say it was luck. Luck really decided whether, yes, you died or survived. But after all that, I didn't find among my women one single case of one of the women doing down another woman in order to do better herself. Not one.
Well, it's remarkable. And very important to say.
Mm.
All right, but now I'm going to sort of almost the opposite point. And this relates to things that I've already said about, for example, Martha Gellhorn, so that you know that I belonged, as it were, the muckraking school of biography. I think that so much of the truth about us resides on our sad and bad side that biographers must tell it.
Yes.
Now, you don't cover this side up in A Train in Winter. However, you do emphasize the positive, because that's your theme to do with friendship. But I'm wondering, did you repress or suppress or omit any of the bad, sad stuff out of a care for the survivors still living and their families?
I think I certainly omitted a bit. I omitted when one of the women told me what the fact that she'd been in the camp had done to her children. And she said at the end, please don't write this. And I think if anybody says to me, please don't write this, I don't write it. And occasionally, I didn't write things where I thought they would have no idea what it would look like in print. So yes, there were things I took out. And in this book, my new book, there is an incident which I make light of for the same reason. That the people are living, that there is disagreement over it, and that it would be very painful to one person. I kind of feel it's the right thing to do.
Yes, I mean, I think it is another one of these absolutely crucial questions. Whether a book is worth, if you can put it so crudely, you know, as much or more than a human being. I had the privilege and good luck and absolute delight of interviewing Philip Roth, because he knew Primo Levi. And I said some things about my worries at the time that were just like this, about some things that perhaps I shouldn't say. And he looked at me. He's very tall, you know. He looked down at me and he said, piss or get off the pot.
Did he?
Yes, he did. He did. I mean, it seemed to me that that was, you know, the ruthless writer point of view, that you should never put anybody, starting with yourself, ahead of the book. And you must write sub specie alternatis. This book, if you make a book tailored to any individual living human being, it's not the truth. And on the other hand, I've never been able to live up to that myself. But I'm not sure there's a right or a wrong.
It's just an endless discussion. No, there's a right or a wrong for us. I think some time back I worked out what my right and wrong was over that.
Should we just finish by talking briefly, if you're willing, about the second and third books in your trilogy? So the second one is called Village of Secrets, I think. And so can you tell us a bit about that?
When I came to the end of writing A Train in Winter, I realised that I was left with unfinished business because the women were all on the train in January 1943, and I never in the book go back to France at all until after the war. So what I was looking for was a story with resistance that took me to the end of the war. And a friend had seen some reference to one of these villages up in the mountains. And I began to look into it. And it seemed from the original story that everything was done by a single Protestant pastor. And I looked at it and thought, I don't really want to write just a book about a good pastor who saved a lot of people. It's really boring. And then I realised that there'd been this huge controversy because this pastor had wrote his memoirs and filed them away in Swarthmore College. And in the late 1970s, early 1980s, a historian, a French-American historian called Allier, had been to Swarthmore College. And he was a pacifist. And he was looking for something that would somehow prove that pacifism was a very strong force. And he came across Pastor Trotmere's memoirs. And instead of checking up the story, he wrote this book called Lest Innocent Blood Be Shed. And it was the story of a wonderful pastor who, single-handedly, believing in nonviolence and pacifism, had saved 5,000 Jews. So I looked at this and I thought, oh. So then I started sort of combing about and I fell on the pastor who, after Trotmere, served in the same parish. And he said to me, people who read the book said, this is monstrous, it wasn't really like that. Somebody had made a film where they repeated the whole thing again and everybody was furious about that and there were cross currents among my parishioners and I thought to myself, I'm going to put an end to all this, I'm going to have a conference. So we organised in 1990 a conference up on the plateau to which came the savers, the saved, the historians, and so on. And this charming man said to me, it was the single worst thing I did in my whole time as a priest, because what it did was it unleashed this can of worms. And it was at that point that I realised how fascinating this was, because I was writing about memory, really. Memory of goodness. Memory making goodness.
Sounds as though you might run up against a great deal of moral difficulty here, though. You know, if people are claiming different things about... I mean, there's going to be somebody who emerges from this damaged and hurt, either Pastor Trocmé or... No?
In the end, I have been critical of Trocmé.
Uh-huh.
And Trocmé's daughter is alive.
Ah.
Here is one of those cases. There are two or three things I didn't put in, because I thought this is just going too far. This is too offensive to the remaining family members. And the only other thing that has to be said about this book is everybody always says you always write these gloomy books. So I said to my editor, this is going to be great, this is going to be wonderful, it's about all these people who were saved. Actually, when I started writing the book, I realised that what was really interesting was something that people never talk about, were the internment camps in France in the 1930s, before the war and up into the war. And these camps were terrible. So what I decided to do was to write the book in terms of different people who'd gone onto the mountain. And I start them in the different places they were, quite a lot of them, in these different camps. So I'm able to make this book just as gloomy and miserable as everything else.
More accurate, more true. There is one more, isn't there, in this trilogy? And number three, last book of the trilogy, will probably be your farewell to World War II. Was there anything you'd like to say?
Maybe just that I've, again, felt I hadn't quite finished with Resistance, and I wanted to do one more Italian book. And also, my feeling is that people never write about anti-fascism in Italy. They think of the partisans at the end of the war, but nobody thinks of the 20s and 30s, when there were these incredibly brave people who stood up to Mussolini, and they have a terrible end.
Yeah.
So it'll be just as deliciously gloomy as all the others. I suppose I've always been interested in the black side of life. I've always been interested in what people do to each other. I've been interested in loss and fear and the bad things. I mean, that's what I'm drawn to. I'm drawn to writing about that. And I worry sometimes, because I think that people who are drawn inevitably to the dark side, maybe there's something wrong about this. Maybe it's to make oneself feel a bit better or something. I hope I don't do that. But it's difficult to say, because these are the subjects that interest me.
That was Caroline Moorhead in conversation with Carol Angier. You can find out more about Caroline on the RLF website. And that concludes episode 76, which was recorded by Carol Angier and produced by Francis Burns. Coming up in episode 77... Julia Kopis is joined by poets Debjani Chatterjee, Basir Kazmi and Mimi Kalvati to explore the long history and contemporary pleasures of the ghazal, a traditional poetic form that's become increasingly popular in the West. We hope you'll join us. You've been listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. To subscribe to podcasts and to find out more about the work of the RLF, please visit our website at www.rlf.org.uk. Thanks for listening.